to the Royal Studies podcast. I'm delighted today to have Adriana Conchin with us, who is the winner of the Royal Studies Journal Early Career and Postgraduate Student Article Prize. We're very excited to be featuring her article on splendid gifts in today's episode. So I'll be talking in just a minute to Adriana. We're going to hear all about her article. But before I do that, I just want to introduce our special guest. So Adriana Conchin is Assistant Curator of Paintings and Drawings at the V&A Museum in London. She completed her doctoral studies at the Corto in London in 2021, and her dissertation was focused on the wedding of Francesco de' Medici and the Archduchess Joanna of Austria of the Habsburg dynasty. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that marriage as we kind of go on today. So she was looking at the marriage itself, but also the wider cultural implications of it. She was the recipient of several fellowships, including the Eva Schiller Fellowship and the Medici Archive Project in Florence, and the Studio Radolfina Fellowship at Prague in the Institute of Art History and the Czech Academy of Sciences. Adriana also had the Aisha Boldicciani graduate internship at the Frick Collection in New York. So some very kind of prestigious institutions there, which is fantastic. So her research interests lie in 16th century collecting, cultural exchanges between Tuscany and the Holy Roman Empire, and female patronage networks. And all of these you'll see in her prize-winning article, and we'll be hearing more about shortly. So she's published on the cultural relationships between the courts of the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II and Francesco de' Medici, and on the frescoes of the Habsburg cityscape in the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence in Burlington Magazine. So Adriana, what inspired you to write about this topic? How did you get into this particular thing? And how did you find out about the particular role that this architect, Antonio Lupicini, played as this kind of pivot point between the imperial court and Florence?
So the research for my article is actually part of my larger PhD project, or was part of my larger doctoral research, and which in turn was inspired by me being myself half Austrian and half Italian. So my father's family is from Tuscany and my mother's family is from Austria. So when I was looking for a PhD topic to investigate, I decided to kind of rely on my own strengths, my linguistic and cultural strengths, and really try to find a topic that really would combine my background, so to speak. So that's why I decided to look at the Medici dynasty and the Habsburg dynasty in the 16th century, more particularly the Austrian Habsburgs and the Medici in the 16th century. And as an art historian, obviously, I wanted to focus on the cultural aspect of their relationship, on the artistic aspect of their relationship. So it really was an ideal starting point when I found out that actually in the 16th century, the Medici and the Habsburg intermarry for the very first time. So this is the moment where these two great, famous, art-loving dynasties marry into each other for the very first time. And I now wanted to find out what happens next. You know, from the first marriage that takes place between Alessandro de' Medici to Margaret of Austria, who was Charles V's illegitimate daughter, to the second marriage, which was between Francesco de' Medici and Johann of Austria, which in my article comes more to the fore. And then what happens in terms of the artistic and cultural implications. And as I was researching the topic, this Antonio Lupicini kind of always popped up everywhere. I couldn't get away from him. He was a figure that seemed to be everywhere. And in all the different archives I was researching, whatever I was looking at, he seems to have played such an important role. So I thought this, he's a perfect conduit in exploring a certain period. So the late 1570s to the 1580s between two dynasties. So I thought it'd be ideal to use him as a way to trace the two, the relationship between the imperial court and Florence. So.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, one of the things I wanted to kind of poke into was about this marriage, because you note in the article that you know, really the effort here is to repair relations, because the marriage has been, you call it a difficult marriage. Yes. Talk about kind of what happens after the death of Joanna of Austria and how the Medici are trying to kind of rebuild bridges. Now, normally royal marriages are all about creating bonds, but it sounds like this marriage actually did more damage to that relationship, or at least initially. So can you tell us a bit more about this marriage, why it was so difficult and why there was this need to repair relations?
Absolutely. It is a fascinating marriage because it was truly a kind of a political masterstroke by Cosimo Primo de' Medici, who was the very first Grand Duke of Tuscany, so the father of Francesco, who brokered this marriage with Johanna's brother. So again, it was a marriage contracted above her head, but also above the head of Francesco himself. He was never on board from the beginning, and his father was incredibly ambitious to have a Habsburg bride for his son, even though his son at this point was already involved with his Venetian mistress and didn't have much interest in having a northern lady placed by his side as his consort. But he did recognize, Francesco, the importance of the dynastic, of a dynastic marriage to the Habsburgs. He did understand that the Medici, to elevate their position, were in dire need of an imperial bride, which was at this moment almost the highest honor you can have. So initially he conceded to the wedding, but as time progressed and his father passed away, he realized that, you know, this was far from ideal for himself, and he felt very constrained in the marriage, especially as the Habsburgs were very overbearing in-laws and treated the Medici as second-grade citizen, because for the Habsburgs at this time, they were, you know, in control of a global empire, whereas the Medici for them were basically recently ennobled bankers, and they should be grateful for the fact that the Habsburg had bestowed upon them one of their daughters. But that was not how Francesco was behaving. So the relationship soured very quickly, and Johanna of Austria herself would complain to her brother, who was Holy Roman Emperor. Then her nephew became Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II, and she would constantly complain about how terrible her husband was treating her. And that really led to the breakdown of diplomatic relations, political relations. So that kind of was the state when Johanna passed away. And then that is what led to Francesco to realize, okay, now his wife has passed away, it's the moment for me to try to kind of smooth over this very kind of, you know, contentious relationship he had been having with the Habsburgs.
Now, I think you've touched on something really important, I think, that we always find in royal studies, that dynastic marriages were absolutely vital, right? They were this political tool. But yes, there are two people involved in this marriage as well, and they might not get along, and they might, you know, they might have their heart, you know, been taken elsewhere, as seems to be the case for Francesco. And so, yeah, a difficult marriage personally can lead to political problems, can it?
Absolutely. And they didn't share a common language. She struggled with Italian. She barely could speak it. It was really difficult for her. They didn't have any common interest. Francesco's famous for his pursuit of alchemy.
Ah.
He had no interest in alchemy, quite the opposite. She was really religiously devout and thought alchemy was the devil's work. So there were so many kind of points of, you know, fracture and dissent between the two. And I think the most pivotal thing was she would not give birth to male heir. So she was not fulfilling her role. And this was absolutely crucial in their relationship, the fact that she was simply not giving birth to a male heir. Up until almost the end of her life, 2 years before she passed away, she did give birth to a male heir, which kind of shortly, for a very short time, improved their relationships. But unfortunately, also, he died very young. So unfortunately, that then didn't end up being the long-awaited heir due to his, I think he died at 3 years old.
Oh my goodness. So a tragic tale, definitely. Definitely. So we can definitely see the reason why, you know, Francesco felt like, I need to kind of get back on the good side of the Habsburgs.
Yes. So left without a wife and left without a male heir. So true things would really motivated him to, you know, repair relations.
Absolutely. So hence the need for these splendid gifts. So, you talk about, it's amazing, the really wide range of things. We've got exotic animals, we've got antiquities, we've got these beautiful cameos, we've got portraits. So given like the volume of kind of gifts that were going, were there particular ones that you thought were the most impactful, perhaps made the best resonance with Rudolf, perhaps?
That's sometimes always really hard to gauge, because we don't have, you know, we don't have information how these gifts were received. Sometimes we do. Sometimes, if we're very lucky, we do have ambassadors who are very ardent in reporting back the reaction of the recipient. So if we're lucky, we will have these rare reports. But in my case, I unfortunately wasn't able to find any kind of indications of how Rudolf felt about all the particular Meiji gifts. What we can say is that the Meiji most definitely covered their bases. I mean, they knew what Rudolf loved and made sure that whatever he kind of was interested in, and they would cover in terms of gifts. We know he was a great lover of heart stones, so they made sure to include a beautiful lapis lazuli vase. They knew he was styling himself as the new great emperor in line with, you know, the ancient Roman Empire, so they made sure they would include ancient Roman cameos. So they really kind of catered to all of these various tastes of him to make sure that, you know, he was almost charmed in all way possible. I always thought the kind of ancient Roman cameos were particularly special because of their value, because of their age, but, you know, and how he could, like how Rudolf could truly harness them in a way for his self-propagation.
No, you're absolutely right. And of course, gifts are only good if you've taken time to think about what the other person might like to receive. So they definitely did their homework there, it sounds like.
They really did. And this is really what the Medici success, they were extremely successful in and really excelled at understanding what kind of gifts and cultural and artistic works they could offer their kind of political allies.
No, excellent, excellent. Well, this is really important because this is the gift giving is only works if you get the right thing. So it sounds like they had the knack. They had the knack.
They really did.
Now, going back to Antonio Lupicini, it seemed a bit sad to me because he spent all this time creating designs for a palace for Rudolf II, but ultimately that didn't take off. And it seems like there was another design by another Bernardo Buonotalenti. Again, he didn't like that either. So was Rudolf really hard to please, or did he just did he enjoy pipe dreaming about palaces more than building them? Why do you think that, you know, they didn't kind of come off?
First of all, I think Rudolf most definitely was incredibly hard to please. You know, he was one of the greatest patrons ever, potentially. And yes, obviously not easy to please. But I think the true reason, and I probably should have fleshed this out a little bit more, was I think his disapproval was hiding several other factors that he probably not openly or willingly wanted to actually reveal about himself. Namely, the fact that his entire court and his ministers were completely against the fact that the court should move to Prague. They all were very happy to stay in Vienna. Vienna had a splendid imperial residence, and they did not want to have their imperial court taken and transplanted to Prague, which was deemed by many courtiers as a secondary city. So that was obviously one of the factors that he did not have the backing of his ministers. And that would also mean that the funding that he would have to raise, and as usual, he's a Habsburg, his coffers were mostly empty, money was always an issue. He was fighting the Ottomans at the border. So, you know, he wasn't very liquid at the time either, and he often would have to go on these big money-raising campaigns to enact his big architectural projects. And in this case, his ministers were not on his side. So I think the two fundamental reasons was he had a cash flow problem alongside the fact that he did not have the support of his court. And it took him another 5 years to kind of convince his court to move with him to Prague. So only in 1583 is Prague officially the new imperial city. So he managed to push it through, but only a few years later. And again, I think the fact that none of the palaces got built, and what instead happened was he, in an almost piecemeal approach, every year he added in Prague, when he then moved to Prague, a wing or a little apartment or a new corridor, kind of shows that he was only able to raise funds and support for small scale building projects. And he never really managed to push through with a big, big architectural endeavor, unfortunately.
Oh, that's really interesting. It's funny. It's something that I talk about with my own kind of students when we do Renaissance court, is that kings and queens and emperors in this case have the choice of kind of build, buy or restore kind of thing.
Yes.
Do they build something new from scratch? That's the dream, but it's hard to achieve and it's very expensive. Do you kind of buy somewhere and do it up kind of thing, like Kensington Palace is a great example, or Buckingham Palace? Or do you just end up kind of doing your own little tweaks and additions? And it sounds like his option, his first choice option of build wasn't on the table. So he went for a bit of restoration instead.
And tweaking, exactly that. And he's also had his father as an example. His father, Emperor Maximilian II, He actually embarked on a large-scale project building a humongous new palace on the outskirts of Vienna called the Neugebäude, and he never managed to finish it, and it very quickly fell into ruin. So he also had this example that his father tried to, emptied all the coffers, built this palace, and it was never in use and quickly deteriorated, and today is still in ruins.
So, oh, very sad, yes.
It shows that it was a very difficult undertaking to start from scratch, especially at that very moment in history.
Absolutely.
You have the Ottoman army at your doorstep. So a lot of the money had to go towards the war effort.
And like you said, it's very hard to convince your ministers when you have the major kind of military threat ongoing, yes, that you really, yes, want to spend a lot of money on a palace instead. It doesn't,
absolutely,
go to
plan. So they had to be extremely pragmatic and just say no.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for this kind of glimpse into your article. But I kind of wanted to end by thinking a bit more about kind of what you're working on at the moment, or kind of where you're going. Are you still developing more kind of aspects of this relationship, or is your research taking you in a different direction? Tell us a bit about what you're working on at the moment.
Oh, yes, I'd love to. So I am still working on a topic as a whole. I'd love to publish my dissertation as a book, and really kind of trace the history throughout the 16th century. So give a really wide overview of the Habsburg-Meiji relationship in the 16th century. So I'm hoping to do that very soon. I'm working on the book manuscript now. But I've also expanded my research, still kind of Meiji-Habsburg focus, but focusing on the Meiji and Habsburg in relation to the Indian subcontinent. So I've worked on the Medici and their involvement with the Mughal Empire, really trying to think about global art history and how we can start probably with like perhaps a more European-focused research, but then expand it and open it up. I mean, there's been so much great research done in relation to Latin America. So my research was the Meiji and the Mughal Empire, and that will be my next article that's going to come out. And I'm really excited about that, thinking about the Renaissance globally.
Oh, that is music to my ears. I'm so excited. So yes, please do keep me posted on that, because that's something I feel that we absolutely desperately need, yes, in world studies, is that global perspective.
Yes, and the Mughal court is perfect because it's an empire. It's an empire made up of imperial courts itself. So the court structure is really similar. It's very comparable. And they were a trading nation. They were a naval nation. So it felt like the most appropriate ways to connect what I was doing to a much larger, broader empire. And yeah, cultural exchanges globally.
That sounds so exciting. And really, it's quite interesting because I know that there's been a lot of look at like perhaps Thomas Rowe's embassy,
yes,
to the Mughal court, but the Medici. Yeah, that's really exciting to think about.
And I touch upon Thomas Rowe as well, because the Medici, being very nosy and well-informed, always kind of kept tabs on Thomas Rowe. They were greatly interested with what he was doing. So we've got a wealth of information in the Florentine archives on Thomas Rowe and his mission. And the Medici were keen to mimic it. So they took him as a role model. They thought, oh, if he can do it, we should start trading with the Mughal Empire. So you've got this wonderful network of information, exchanges, diplomacy. So yes, he'll be playing a part in my research as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. I can't wait to see how that develops. That is absolutely fantastic.
Thank
you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, Adriana. And again, congratulations on your fantastic article, Splendid Gifts. We will be highlighting it in the December issue of the Royal Studies Journal, and we'll be kind of pointing our readers towards it to read it and to hear more about your research as it develops. We're very excited to see this kind of Mughal-Medici connection.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and what an honor to be receiving this prize. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks again.